I would explain to the yak that we monks believed in reincarnation. I would explain that we each came down to this earth to do our appointed task and to learn our appointed lessons so that in the heavenly fields we could prepare to journey on to even higher things. Well spoken, monk, well spoken, said my captor. I regret exceedingly that it takes one of the lower orders to give me a sense of perspective. Yes, you are right. You have amazed me greatly, monk, by the perception you have shown and, I must say, by your intransigence, because you have been rather firmer than I should be if I should be so unfortunate as to be placed in comparable circumstances. I felt bold now, so I said, you refer to me as one of the lower orders. Before that you referred to me as a savage, uncivilized, uncultured, knowing nothing. You laughed at me when I admitted the truth that I knew nothing of great cities in this world. But, sir, I told you the truth, I told you the truth, I admitted my ignorance, but I am seeking to lighten that ignorance and you are not helping me. I ask you again, sir, you have made me captive entirely against my will, you have engaged in great liberties with my body, the temple of my soul. You have indulged in some most remarkable events, apparently designed to impress me. I might be more impressed, sir, if you answered my question, because I know what I want to know. I ask you again, who are you? For some time he just stood there, looking embarrassed. And then he said, in your terminology there are no words, no concepts which would enable me to explain the position. Before a subject can be discussed, a first requisite is that both sides, both parties, shall understand the same terms, shall be able to agree on certain precepts. For the moment let me just tell you that I am one who can be likened to the medical lamas of your Chakporai. I am charged with the responsibility of looking after your physical body and preparing you so that you can be filled with knowledge, when I am satisfied that you are ready to receive that knowledge. Until you are filled with this knowledge, then any discussion on who I am or what I am would be pointless. Just accept for the moment that what we are doing is for the good of others, and that although you may be highly incensed at what you consider to be liberties we are taking with you, yet after, when you know our purpose, when you know what we are, and you know what you and your people are, you will change your opinion. With that he switched off my sight and I heard him leave the room. I was again in the dark night of blindness, and again alone with my thoughts. The dark night of blindness is a dark night indeed. When I had been blinded, when my eyes had been gouged out by the filthy fingers of the Chinese, I had known agony, and even with my eyes removed I had seen, or seemed to see, bright flashes, swirling lights without shape or form. That had subsided throughout subsequent days, but now I had been told that a device had been tapped into my optic nerve and I could indeed believe it, I had every reason to believe it. My captor had switched off my sight, but an after-memory of it remained. Again I was experiencing that peculiar contradictory sensation of numbness and tingling in the head. It might seem absurd to talk of feeling numb and tingling at the same time, but that is how I felt. And I was left with my numb tingling, and all the swirling lights. For a time I lay there considering all that had happened to me. The thought occurred to me that perhaps I was dead, or mad, and all these things were but a figment of a mind leaving the conscious world. My training as a priest came to my rescue. I used age-old discipline to reorientate my thoughts. I stopped reason and so permitted my over-self to take over. No imagination this was the real thing, I was being used, by higher powers for higher purposes. My fright and panic subsided. Composure returned to me and for some time I ticked over in my mind in rhythm to the beating of my heart. Could I have behaved differently, I wondered. Had I exercised all caution in my approach to new concepts? Would the great 13th have acted otherwise if he had been in a similar position? My conscience was clear. My duty was plain. I must continue to act as a good Tibetan priest and all would be well. Peace suffused me, a feeling of well-being enveloped me like a warm yak wool blanket protecting against the cold. Somehow, sometime, I drifted off into a dreamless, untroubled sleep. The world was shifting. Everything seemed to be rising and falling. A strong sensation of motion and then a metallic clang woke me abruptly from my slumber. I was moving, my table was moving. There came the musical chink and tinkle of all the glassware being moved as well. As I remembered, all those things had been attached to the table. Now everything was on the move. Voices surrounded me. High voices, low voices. Discussing me, I feared. But what strange voices, so different from anything I had known. There was movement of my table, but silent movement. No sliding, no grating. Merely a floating. This, I thought, must be how a feather feels when it is blown upon the wind. Then the table motion changed direction. Obviously I was being guided down a corridor. Soon we entered what was clearly a large hall. The echoes gave a resonance of distance, considerable distance. A final rather sickening swaying sweep, and my table clanged down upon what my experience told me was a rock floor. But how could this be? How could I suddenly be in what my senses told me was a cave? My curiosity was soon set at rest, or was it whetted? I have never been sure. There was a continual babble of talk, all in a language quite unknown to me. With the clanging of my metal table upon the rock floor, a hand touched my shoulder and the voice of my captor said, "Now we will give you sight, you should be sufficiently rested by now." There was a scraping and a click. Colors whirled around me, lights flashed, grew dim, and settled down to a pattern. Not a pattern that I understood, not a pattern that conveyed anything to me. I lay there wondering what it was all about. There was an expectant silence. I could feel people looking at me. Then a short, sharp, barked question. My captor's footsteps coming swiftly towards me. "Can you not see?" he asked. "I see a curious pattern," I replied. "I see that which has no meaning for me, a pattern of wavy lines, of swaying colors and flashing lights. That is all I see." He muttered something and hurried away. There was a muted talk and the sound of metallic objects being touched together. Lights flickered and colors flared. Everything whirled in a mad ecstasy of alien patterns, steadied, and I saw. Here was a vast cavern some 200 or more feet high. Its length and breadth were beyond my computation, for they faded into dim darkness far beyond my range of vision. The place was huge and it contained what I could only liken to an amphitheater, the seats of which were filled by, what shall I call them? Creatures which could only have come from a catalogue of gods and devils. Yet strange as these things were, an even stranger object hung poised in the center of the arena. A globe which I perceived to be the world hung before me, slowly rotating, while from afar a light shone upon it as the light from the sun shone upon this earth. There was now a hushed silence. The strange creatures stared at me. I stared back at them, although I felt small and wholly insignificant before this mighty throng. Here were small men and women, seemingly perfect in every detail and of godlike mien, radiating an aura of purity and calm. Others there were who also were man-like but with a curious, quite incredible bird head complete with scales or feathers, I could not at all distinguish which, and with hands which, although human in shape, still had astounding scales and claws. Also there were giants. Immense creatures who loomed like statues and overshadowed their more diminutive companions. These were undeniably human, yet of such size as to overwhelm one's comprehension. Men and women, or male and female. And others who could have been either, or neither. They sat and stared at me until I grew uncomfortable under their steady gaze. To one side sat a godlike creature, stern-visaged and erect. In gorgeous, living colors he sat calmly regal like a god in his heaven. Then he spoke, again in an unknown tongue. My captor hurried forward and bent over me. "I shall put these things in your ears," he said, "and then you will understand every word which is said here. Do not be afraid." He grasped the upper edge of my right ear and pulled it upwards with one hand. With the other he inserted some small device into the ear orifice. Then he leaned over further and did the same to my left ear. He twisted a small knob attached to a box beside my neck and I heard sound. It dawned upon me that I could understand the strange tongue which formerly had been incomprehensible. There was no time to wonder at this marvel. I had perforce to listen to the voices around me, voices which I now understood. Voices which I now understood, a language which I now understood. Yes, but the grandeur of the concepts was far above my limited imagination. I was a poor priest from what had been described as the terrain of savages, and my comprehension was not sufficient to enable me to perceive the meaning of that which I now heard and had thought to be intelligible. My captor observed that I was having difficulties and hastened again towards me. "What is it?" he whispered. "I am too ill-educated to understand the meanings of any except the simpler words," I whispered back. "The things which I heard have no meaning at all for me. I cannot comprehend such lofty thoughts." With a very worried expression on his face, he hesitantly walked to a large official, clad in gorgeous clothes, who stood near the throne of the Great One. There was a whispered conversation, then the two walked slowly towards me. I tried to follow the talk going on about me, but succeeded not at all. My captor leaned over me and whispered, "Explain to the adjutant your difficulty." "Adjutant?" I said to him, "I do not even know what the word means." Never before had I felt so inadequate, so ignorant, so utterly frustrated. Never before had I felt so out of my depth. The adjutant person smiled down at me and said, "Do you understand what I am saying to you?" "I do indeed, sir," was my reply, "but I am utterly ignorant of the whole matter of the Great One's talk. I cannot comprehend the subject, the concepts are beyond me." He nodded his head and replied, "Our automatic translator obviously is to blame. It is not fitted to your metabolism nor to your brain pattern." "No matter, the Surgeon General, whom we believe you refer to as your captor, will deal with the matter and will prepare you for the next session. This is a trifling delay and I will explain it to the Admiral." He nodded amiably to me and strode off to the Great One. "Admiral?" What was an Admiral, I wondered. What was an Adjutant? The terms had no meaning at all for me. I composed myself to await developments. The one referred to as the Adjutant reached the Great One and spoke quietly to him. It all appeared very unhurried, very tranquil. The Great One nodded his head, and the adjutant beckoned to the one who was called Surgeon General, or my captor. He went forward, and there was an animated discussion. At last my captor put his right hand to his head in the strange gesture which I had noticed, turned towards me, and walked briskly to me at the same time making motions apparently to someone beyond my range of vision. The talk continued. There had been no interruption. A large man was on his feet and I had the impression that he was discussing something about food supplies. A strange female jumped to her feet and made some sort of answer. It appeared to be a strong protest at something which the man had said. Then with face red, with anger, she sat down abruptly. The man continued unperturbed. My captor reached me and muttered, "You have disgraced me. I said you were an ignorant savage." Crossly he wrenched the things from my ears. With a quick sweep of his hand he did something which instantly deprived me of sight again. There was the rising sensation, and I felt my table moving away from that huge cave. Not at all carefully my table and equipment was pushed along a corridor. There came metallic squeaks and clangs, a sudden change of direction, and an unpleasant feeling of falling. With quite a bang my table hit the floor and I guessed that I was again in the metal room from whence I came. Curt voices, the rustle of cloth and the shuffle of feet. The slither of the sliding metal door, and I was left alone again with my thoughts. What was it all about? WHO was the Admiral? What was the Adjutant? And WHY was my captor called Surgeon General? What was this place? The whole thing was far, far beyond me. I lay there with burning cheeks, feeling hot all over. I was mortified almost beyond endurance that I had comprehended so very, very little. Quite definitely I had acted like an ignorant savage. They must have thought as I would have thought if I had regarded a yak as a sentient person and had so addressed him, but without result. Perspiration broke out all over me as I contemplated how I had brought shame to my priestly caste by my sheer inability to understand. I felt terrible. The rye lay, enmeshed in my misery, prey to the darkest and most ignoble thoughts, full of the deep suspicion that we all were savages to these unknown people. I lay there, and sweated. The door screeched open and giggling and chattering uproar filled the room. Those unmentionable females again. With great elan they ripped off my single sheet once again, leaving me as naked as a newborn baby. Without ceremony I was rolled onto my side, a cold sheet of something clammy was slid under my length, and violently I was rolled back to the other side. There was a sharp yank as the edge of the sheet was pulled further under me. For a moment I feared that I would be precipitated off the table. Female hands grasped me and urgently scoured me with sharp, stinging solutions. Roughly I was rubbed dry with what felt to be old sacking. The most intimate portions of my body were prodded and poked and strange implements were introduced. Time dragged on, I was goaded almost beyond endurance, but there was naught that I could do. Most thoroughly had I been immobilized against just such a contingency. But then began such an assault upon me that at first I feared I was being tortured. Females gripped my arms and legs and twisted them and bent them at all angles. Hard hands dug into the muscles of my body and kneaded me as though I were but a mass of dough. Knuckles made depressions in my organs and I was left gasping for air. My legs were wrenched far apart and the unceasingly chattering females drew long woolen sleeves over my feet, up my legs, and near unto my thighs. I was lifted by the back of my neck so that I was bent forward from the waist. Some form of garment was thrust around my upper body and appeared to be tied over my chest and abdomen. A strange, evil-smelling foam impinged upon my scalp and instantly a rattling buzz sounded. The source of the buzz touched me and made even my teeth rattle, the few I had remaining after the Chinese had knocked most of them out. There was a shearing sensation that reminded me of yaks being shorn of their wool. A rough wipe, so rough that I felt the skin must surely peel, and another form of mist landed upon my defenseless head. The door slithered again, and there came the sound of male voices. One I recognized, that of my captor. He came to me, and using my own language, said, "We are going to expose your brain, there is nothing to worry about. We are going to put electrodes right into your." The words had no meaning for me except to indicate that I was in for another bad time and that I could do nothing at all about it. Strange odors pervaded the air. The chattering females fell silent. All talk ceased. Metal clanged against metal. There came the gurgle of fluids and I felt a sudden sharp prick in my upper left arm. Violently my nose was grasped and some strange tubular device was rammed up my nostrils, and down my throat. Around my skull I felt a succession of sharp pricks which instantly gave way to numbness. There came a high-pitched whine and a most horrid machine touched my skull and crawled all around it. It was sawing off the top of my head. The terrible, grinding pulsation penetrated every atom of my being. I had the impression that every bone in my whole body was vibrating in protest. At last, as I could well feel, the whole of the top of my head was cut off with the exception of a small flap of flesh which left my skull hinged at that point. By now I was in a state of terror, a strange form of terror, because although I was terrified, yet I determined that death itself would not make me murmur. Indescribable sensations now assailed me. Without any obvious reason I suddenly uttered a long drawn out, ah-ha-ha. Then my fingers began violently to twitch. A stinging in my nostrils made it imperative that I sneeze violently, but I could not sneeze. But worse was to follow. Suddenly there stood before me my maternal grandfather. He was clad in the dress of a government official. He was speaking to me with a kind smile on his face. I looked at him, then the impact came to me. I did not look at him. I had no eyes. What magic was this? At my amazed exclamation, during which the apparition of my grandfather vanished, my captor moved to my side. What is it? He queried. I told him. Oh, that's nothing. He exclaimed. We are merely stimulating certain centers of your brain that you may comprehend them more easily. We see that you have ability, but you have been sunk in the sloth and stupor of superstition and will not permit yourself to open your mind. We are doing it for you. A female screwed the small ear devices into my ear orifices, and for her roughness she might well have been screwing tent pegs into hard soil. There was a click and I could understand the outlandish language. I could comprehend too. Words like cortex, medulla oblongata, psychosomatic, and other terms were now clear to me in their meanings and implications. My basic intelligence quotient was being enhanced, and I knew what it all meant. But it was an ordeal. It was exhausting. Time seemed to stand still. People appeared to walk around endlessly. Their idle chatter was unceasing. The whole affair became entirely boring. I longed to be out and away, out from this place of strange odors, from this place where the top of my head had been cut off like the top of a hard-boiled egg. Not that I had ever seen a hard-boiled egg, that was for the traders and those who had money, not for poor priests who lived on Tsanpa. From time to time people would address remarks to me, questions. How was I? Did I have pain? Did I think I saw something? What color did I imagine I saw? My captor stood beside me a while and told me that various centers were being stimulated and that I should, during the course of the treatment, experience sensation which could frighten me. Frighten me? I had been frightened the whole time, I told him. He laughed at that and casually remarked that as a result of the treatment I was now having I should have to live as a solitary hermit the whole of a long life because of the increased perceptions I should have. Never would anyone live with me, he said, until almost at the end of my life a young man would come to take all the knowledge I had and to carry it on and eventually place it before an unbelieving world. At last, after what appeared to be an eternity, my bony skull cap was replaced. Strange metal clips were pushed in to join the two halves together. A strip of cloth was wound round and round my head, and all departed save one female who sat beside me. From the rustle of paper it was evident that she was reading instead of paying attention to her duties. There came the soft plop of a book falling and then rhythmic snores from the female. I decided that I too would sleep. Chapter 5. In the cave the old hermit suddenly ceased to speak, and placed his hands with fingers outspread on the sandy earth beside him. Lightly those sensitive fingers made contact with the soil. For a moment he concentrated, then said, "Shortly we shall receive a visitor." The young monk looked at him in a dumbfounded manner. Visitor? What visitor would be coming here? And how was he so sure? There had been no sound, no change in the voices of nature beyond the cave. For perhaps 10 minutes they sat thus, erect, expectant. Suddenly the bright-limbed oval that was the entrance to the cave dimmed and became a black blur. "Are you there, hermit?" yelled a high-pitched voice. For why do hermits live in such dark and inaccessible places? Into the cave waddled a short, very fat monk with a sack over his shoulder. "I've brought you some tea and barley," he said. It was for the hermitage of far beyond, but they won't want it any more and I'm not carrying this lot back. With a gasp of satisfaction he swung the sack from his shoulder and let it fall to the ground. Like a tired man he sank to the ground too and sat with his back propped up against a wall. How slovenly, thought the young monk, why does he not sit correctly as we do? Then the answer came to him. The other monk was too fat to sit cross-legged with any degree of comfort. The old hermit spoke mildly, "Well, what news, messenger? Is the great outside this working?" The messenger monk groaned and wheezed. "I wish you would give me something for this fat," he said. "They tell me at Chakpori that I have glandular trouble, but they do not give me anything to make it better." His eyes, now adjusted to the deep gloom of the cave, after leaving the bright sunlight, glanced around. "Oh, I see you have the young man here," he said. "I heard he was coming to you. How is he making out? As bright as they say?" Without waiting for an answer, he went on, "Rockfall up higher a few days ago. Keeper of the Hermitage at Far Beyond got caught by a boulder and fell over the cliff. Vulture stuffing now, eh?" He went off into peals of laughter at the thought. "Hermit in the cave died of thirst," he went on. "There was only the keeper and the perpetual hermit, and he was walled up. No water, no life, eh?" The young monk sat silent, thinking of the solitary hermits. Strange men who had a call to retire from all and every contact with the world of man. With a monk volunteer such a solitary would journey up the mountainside and find a hermitage which had been abandoned. Here he would enter an inner room which had no window. His volunteer keeper would build a wall so that the hermit would never again be able to leave the room. In the wall would be just one small opening large enough to take a bowl. Through this opening, once every 2 days, would be passed a bowl of water from a nearby mountain spring, and just a handful of grain. Not a single chink of light would ever enter the hermit's room so long as he lived. Never again would he speak or be spoken to. Here, for as long as he lived, he would remain in contemplation, freeing the astral body from the physical and journeying far in the astral planes. No illness, no change of mind would secure his release. Only death would do that. Outside the sealed room, the keeper would live and have his own existence, always being sure that no sound reached the immured hermit. Should the keeper fall ill and die, or should he fall over the cliff, then the hermit must die too, usually of thirst. In that very small room, unheated no matter how severe the winter, the hermit would have his being. A bowl of cold water every 2 days. Cold water, never warmed, no tea, just the coldest of cold water from the spring which ran direct from the icy mountain slopes. No hot food. One handful of barley every 2 days. At first the pangs of hunger would be terrible as the stomach shrank. The pangs of thirst would be worse. The body would become dehydrated, almost brittle. Muscles would waste away through lack of food, water, and exercise. The normal body functions would almost cease as less water and less food were taken. But the hermit would never leave the room. All that had to be done, all that nature compelled him to do, would have to be done in one corner of the room where time and cold would reduce waste to frozen dust. Sight would go. At first there would be vain straining against the perpetual blackness. Imagination would in the early stages supply strange lights, almost authentic well-lit scenes. The pupils would dilate and the eye muscles atrophy so that should an avalanche destroy the roof, the sunlight would burn out the hermit's sight as surely as though he had been struck by lightning. Hearing would become abnormally acute. Imaginary sounds would appear to float in to torment the hermit. Snatches of conversation would seem to originate in thin air and be cut off as soon as he attempted to listen. The balance would go next. He would find that he toppled over sideways, or frontways, or backwards. Soon he would hear his approach to a wall. The slightest disturbance of the air by raising an arm would sound as a windstorm. Before long he would hear his heart beat like a mighty engine throbbing away. There would come the loud gurgling of fluids within the body, the exhalation of organs disgorging their secretions and, as his hearing became even more acute, the faint slithering of muscle tissue on muscle tissue. The mind would play strange tricks on the body. Erotic pictures would plague the glands. The walls of the black room would seem to crowd in. The hermit would have the strongest sensation of being crushed. Breathing would become hard, labored, as the air became stale. Only every 2 days was the stone removed from the small gap in the inner wall so that a bowl of water, a handful of barley, and life-giving air could enter. Then it would be blocked up again. When the body was mastered, when all the emotions had been conquered, the astral vehicle would float free like smoke, rising from a bonfire. The material body would lie supine on the littered floor and only the silver cord would unite the two. Through the stone walls would pass the astral. Down the precipitous paths it would wander while it savored the joys of being free from the chains of the flesh. Into lama's eyes it would creep and telepathic and clairvoyant lamas would converse with it.